This is The Guardian.
Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonizing the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.
Country first, party second. And it is surely clear to everyone that our country needs a bigger reset.
Anger amongst pensioners and farmers after Freebiegate, after the resignation of Louise Haig. Is this a bit of a reset, would you say?
No, we've been working on this since the early days of government.
It is a privilege to open the debate on the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill. Piece of legislation which would give dying people, under very stringent criteria, choice, autonomy and dignity at the end of their lives.
The ayes to the right, 330. The noes to the left, 275.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian.
So we're here in The Guardian's offices, unusually for us, Kieran, this morning.
Isn't it? Look at all this space around us.
Massive studio, loads of equipment, no mice, crucially. So this is quite, I think it's a promotion for us, really, this morning. But it might feel like an entire lifetime ago, but it's only 5 months, isn't it, since Keir Starmer stood on the steps of Downing Street with a massive majority and he promised the country change. That's what people voted for. Yet, 5 months on and against a backdrop of lousy headlines and protests and low poll ratings, this Thursday, Keir Starmer is expected to announce his plan for change, which we're told very much is not a reset, but will be setting out the government's key milestones and objectives. So why do we think they're doing it now?
Well, first of all, I would say that the plan that was supposed to be in place, that Sue Gray had apparently been working on for a long time while Labour was in opposition, didn't really come to much. I mean, whether it was there at all or not, I think lots of cabinet ministers feel there was nothing there in the first place. So they had a kind of a false start, I think, and now they feel like they've slightly got back into the groove. But let me tell you why I think they're doing it now. And I've got some stats to tell you.
Excellent. Love a stat.
Keir Starmer's ratings since coming in have plunged faster than any British prime minister in the modern era. They've gone from plus 11 before the election to minus 33. He is now the most unpopular leader out of the four main parties. The party has dropped about 5 points in the polls. The Tories have risen four. They're about neck and neck now in the polls, which is faster, I think, than I've seen any government go from landslide victory to potentially behind in the polls. Labour, since coming into power, has lost 40% of the council seats it has defended. Its vote share has fallen by 10 points or more in half of them. The Tories have won more of those council seats than any other party. So that's 2 points of worry for Labour. Not only are they falling, but the Tories seem to be picking up ground. And this, of course, is all against the backdrop of the fact that the Labour won the biggest majority in July. The party won the biggest majority in modern era with the lowest vote share of any winning party. Yeah. So its electoral coalition is unstable. It's weak. The party has plummeted. The leader has plummeted. And all right, they're saying it's not a reset, but it looks to all intents and purposes as if that's exactly what's going on.
What's interesting, though, is I've spoken to a lot of people in and around Downing Street and Keir Starmer over the last few days about this. And actually inside Downing Street, things are a bit calmer than they've been. I mean, the briefing stopped with the departure of Sue Gray. It's sort of like a happier ship in that they're all pulling in one direction. There's not, no longer these sort of two separate power bases, in as much as Sue Gray had a power base. And they believe you know, some of the more sanguine members of that top team believed that it was inevitable that there was going to be a backlash to the budget, which put up taxes by 40 billion quid, that there was no way that you could do some of those difficult things without having an impact, not just on the polls, but also on Keir Starmer's personal ratings. But even despite that sort of, you know, we just need to concentrate on the long term and not be swayed by polls and unhappiness and jitteriness amongst MPs, there is still this sort of profound anxiety amongst some of those that I spoke to that they are not telling a better story. And there's two bits to this. And number 10, people inside Downing Street have been back and forth on this as to what's more important. Is it more important just to deliver, you know, really kind of material change in sometimes in quite small ways, we talked about this before, that will actually make a difference to people so that in 5 years' time, they can turn around and they can say, actually, you know what, waiting lists are down and, you know, small boat crossings are down and kids have better life chances by virtue of focus on early years, those sorts of things. And they've come to the conclusion that that delivery is, of course, fundamental. But what they've also decided in more recent times, and they didn't always think this, is that you also need to shout about it. You can't just do the change. You need to kind of be the change. You need to own it and make it clear to people that it's because of the often difficult steps that you've been taking. And they recognise that they don't have that narrative yet, that story yet. It's been particularly difficult for Starmer because he's frankly not a storyteller. It's not his style. It's not his forte. And somebody mentioned over the weekend to me, you know, cast your mind back to Gordon Brown, who was another leader, another prime minister, who maybe personally wasn't that popular. And, you know, his own personal ratings were pretty low. And they came up with that catch line, which I love for him, which was not flash, just Gordon.
Yeah,
and they made a virtue of the fact that actually, you know, he's pretty dependable, reliable, would get on with the job in hand. And Starmer is kind of the same, dependable, reliable, get on with the job. Let's make a virtue of it, they said. But actually, it's in danger of making him come across as, you know, they've got this sort of sense of torpor. What are they actually doing? Mm. So I think that's what this Thursday is about. It's about seizing that moment and actually saying, you know what, actually, yes, there are some deliverables attached to the big missions, the five missions that he set up for the election. But also, we're going to tell a story about it.
Isn't part of the problem here that that tagline worked well for Gordon Brown when he was Prime Minister, because actually the country wasn't necessarily in a mood for change. And it was fine for Gordon Brown to embody competence and dependability because the country was in that place. The problem is now Keir Starmer's trying to sell a message of change, but in no way does he actually embody the change himself. He looks like, he sounds like, he is a white man of a certain age who has a background essentially in kind of civil service type jobs. He looks like a person from the machine. So if you're trying to sell change, you really have to work hard if you don't look like that change and you don't come across like that change. And I think that's part of the disconnect that's going on here. And at first, I think it kind of worked in that what they were saying was, well, actually, the change you need is stability versus the instability of the Tory years. But I think what they've realised, and part of the reason for this speech, is that simply selling stability is not going to get them through the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. People need more than just, well, we didn't crash the car over our period in government, and the problems in the country are more deep-seated than that.
And actually the people at the very heart of Labour, Keir Starmer, Pat McFadden, who runs the missions for the government, and of course Morgan McSweeney, the Chief of Staff, are all people who are on the side of caution when it comes to not wanting to rock the boat of the electoral coalition, which, as you rightly identified, is pretty shallow. And already Morgan McSweeney is thinking about how Labour goes into the next general election in 4 or 5 years' time and what they need to deliver. So just to remind people, before the election, Keir Starmer set out these very policy-rich, broad, thematic pieces of work, which he called his missions for government. And it was his, you know, he's never really been sort of like a values-based politician. He's a sort of get-stuff-done politician, but this is as close as he'd come to it. And they basically were around opportunity, education, the economy, crime, the green agenda, and the NHS. And they were basically sort of the foundations, if you like, for what Labour would do in government. And then just before the election was called, he set out his Fresh Steps for Change. So these were like six. These, in fact, were six.
Well, they were six. Do you remember why he had to go for six?
Because he added in migration, yeah. didn't he? Because, of course, migration and the economy, the two big issues which the public are really concerned about, all the polling suggests, or most concerned about. So they added in migration. And what people in Downing Street say about this reset, not a reset, on Thursday, is that this is the answer to the inevitable question was, well, if that's the first steps, so you've got the first steps now, you've got the missions, which are going to be at the end of the parliament. How do you, you know, what do you do in between? And that apparently is what this plan for change is about. They've been talking about it since the summer. It's the next staging post, if you like. They're going to focus on half a dozen of them. There was a bit of to and fro as to whether migration would be included as a specific plan. My understanding is it won't be, but it's but it will be mentioned mm-hmm. as a sort of a broader goal and ambition. Mm-hmm. I think because they realise that targets on either irregular migration or legal migration, you know, you're hostage to fortune in mm-hmm. those instances. But there will be very specific ones about, for example, getting several thousand children ready for school, the amount of time it takes to get operations and procedures, and the public will be able to measure Labour's progress against those targets. One of the immediate responses to this has been, and let's take the NHS one, which was that 92% of patients would wait no longer than 18 weeks from referral to treatment by 2029. And that's a target that hasn't been hit, for more than a decade. There's been an immediate response to that from parts of the NHS suggesting that if you focus everything on operations and procedures, then what happens to mental health provision or what happens to accidents and emergencies? And there's been some quite stark warnings. I think, you know, the slight problem the government has here, and well, any government has, is that politics ultimately is about choices, and that not all of those are easy. And if you prioritise anything, is going to mean that other aspects are going to be less of a priority. And with the NHS in particular, which so much of which is struggling, that's a particular problem.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that this is obviously a return to Blairite targets. And I think that if you talk to people who were in government at the time, they regard them as having been pretty successful in driving public sector performance improvement. But of course, there were then unintended consequences. It's not just that you're prioritizing one thing ahead of another. It's that people will kind of manipulate things to hit the number that you have put out there for them to hit. So they'll kind of downgrade other things, or they'll list certain things as not counting within certain target ranges or whatever. There are ways to fudge the numbers. But I think that what Keir Starmer has done is say, yeah, we understand that is a risk, but we think this is still the best way to actually drive pretty rapid public sector improvement. But even as Downing Street was preparing for that, I think we kind of get another indication of the troubles that have hit this government ever since they took over, with the first cabinet resignation for this government, which was Louise Hague's transport secretary standing down after kind of quite a complicated set of events. Mm. Just to break it down for anybody who wasn't necessarily reading or listening to the news at the end of last week, Louise Hague, when she was in her mid-20s, was mugged on a night out in London and lost a bunch of stuff. She thought that a work phone was among those things. It later turned out that she still had the work phone. She turned it on. Work realised. The police realised, because she'd already made a statement to the police saying that her phone had been stolen. The police called her in. She had no real defence here. And she kind of admitted and received a conviction for fraud. I mean, pretty low level. Mm. There was no serious punishment attached to it.
And she declared it, didn't she, when she was appointed to the shadow cabinet?
Then she gets appointed to the shadow cabinet by Keir Starmer. She tells him that this has happened. And he says, as far as we could tell, Downing Street's not denying this. That's fine. I understand. Just one of those things. It's very unfortunate, but don't worry. Then it becomes public last week. Some excellent reporting by some of our colleagues in the lobby. And as soon as it becomes public, Downing Street says, well, there seems to be some new information here. We still don't know what the new information was. It's being hinted at maybe that because her employer at the time, Aviva, launched an investigation and there were some suggestions, maybe there was another phone that had gone missing unaccounted for. But we can't really tell what it was, apart from the fact that this was now public and embarrassing that led Keir Starmer to sack his transport secretary.
And she recognised that she was going to become a distraction. But of course, it inevitably fuels suspicions that she was probably the most left-wing or one of the most left-wing members of the cabinet. Would he have fought harder for somebody that was maybe not so far to the left of the cabinet? It fuels those, obviously it fuels those.
Yeah. And if you look at his letter in response to her resignation, I said he sacked her. I mean, she was lent on to resign. his response to her was about one paragraph long. I think you can tell what his views were on this.
And of course, the other big thing which happened at the end of last week was that the assisted dying bill passed its first Commons hurdle, the second reading, by 330 votes to 275. Now, that doesn't mean it automatically becomes law. The legislative process is such that it takes months for bills to go through, sometimes more. And all it means is it's got to the next stage for MPs to carry on the debate and potentially to amend some of the legislation. Now, it was a really profound debate. And I've sat through many in my 20 years of covering Westminster. And, you know, I felt it was one of those that showed MPs at their best, actually, that, you know, they get bad press a lot of the time, sometimes deservedly, I have to say. But it was very thoughtful. You know, this is one of the sort of most significant ethical issues of our time, really. And because they've been given a free vote, they were allowed to express their real opinion rather than necessarily the party line, even though Keir Starmer obviously voted for the legislation. And Kim Leadbeater, who proposed the debate and took it forward as a private member's bill, I think regardless of where it goes going forward, and it's not guaranteed yet that it will come into legislation or come into force, as lots of people have lots of concerns about it, I think that she has actually, you know, done this country a huge service by creating an opportunity for the debate to happen in the first place. It's long overdue.
If this does pass, I was trying to think about this on Friday, she will go down in history as one of the most influential politicians from outside government. I mean, her and Nigel Farage, basically, are two people who have helped, if this does pass, as I say, helped produce monumental change for this country, but and done so from, you know, not in a ministerial position. That's really unusual.
But of course, there's no guarantees it necessarily will pass. Despite those numbers, it would take about, I think it's 27, 28 MPs to change their minds. And lots of them over the weekend or even in the debate said that they would back it for now to enable the debate to keep going. But that did not necessarily mean that they'd made their mind up for sure. And one of the biggest concerns, and actually one of the issues which is, I think, has made some MPs stop and take stock, some of those that backed it, is the issue of palliative care. And what became really clear to many of them during that debate, when on listening to their colleagues, is that the state of palliative care in this country is dire. It's not properly funded. It's barely funded at all by the government. And many people don't get the palliative care they need. And I think what's happened is that some of those who are perhaps a little bit uncertain are now thinking, you know what, actually, we either need to make sure that if we advance with this legislation, we also transform the palliative care system. The two have to go hand in hand. Or we have to reform the palliative care system and make it fit for purpose before we even get on to the debate about assisted dying. And as we've reported in The Guardian this morning, there's been this blueprint drawn up by doctors, MPs and charities to deliver that transformation of care for about 100,000 people a year in the final stages of life. And I think that's going to be really interesting to see how that debate develops, how the government responds to that, because I think that could change the final outcome of the legislation.
Yeah, potentially. I was there, you know, watching the vote take place in real time in the Commons and saw kind of the aftermath. And it really felt like the Commons had kind of come to a decision, actually. And the congratulations for Kim Leadbeater, you know, as soon as the vote was held, people were turning around and congratulating her. She was walking out and she signed copies of the bill. Mm. And it just felt like some people might change their mind, but that felt like that was the will of the Commons at the time. I'd be surprised if it doesn't go all the way through now.
Yeah, but we'll obviously keep our eye on that. One other thing which some of our listeners may have missed over the weekend was the launch of a new reality TV show featuring none other than the former MP, Tory MP Jacob Rees-Mogg, and his family. I mean, I think his life was always a bit of a pantomime. Now it's a pantomime that we can all have a look at. But reality TV can make or break politicians, can't it, Kieran? I mean, how many have been in the jungle now? You know, Nigel Farage, Matt Hancock.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the people for whom it works and people for whom it really doesn't. Mm. So it was regarded to have worked pretty well for Nigel Farage, but for Matt Hancock, he was, you know, it really backfired.
Nigel Farage because it introduced him to a younger audience. Matt Hancock because he was pleading for forgiveness and the nation wasn't ready to forgive him.
I guess that's true. And it just depends where the nation's mood is and whether they're willing to hear the raw, unvarnished. I suspect Jacob Rees-Mogg will do quite well out of this.
Yeah.
You know, he'll lean into his slightly ridiculous persona and people will guffaw along like they used to do with Boris Johnson. I might be wrong.
And I mean, MPs, obviously we've had Strictly with Ed Balls. We've mentioned I'm a Celebrity. But there have been more serious documentaries and sort of reality shows that politicians have got involved in. I always remember the one with Matthew Paris, the former Tory MP, yeah, who I think it was a World in Action that he did, where they challenged him to live on the minimum sum that was being handed out in benefits to people. Mm. And he couldn't do it. Mm. And he says now that it was a wake-up call about actually what life on the breadline was like. So, you know, they're not always just a bit of comedy.
Yeah, Ian Duncan Smith did something very similar, didn't he? He went into
Easter
a tower
house,
block.
Easter
yeah.
House in Glasgow.
Yeah, that was
and it
huge.
Transformed how he regarded poverty as well. And on the back of it, he ended up going, you know, going ahead when he became Work and Pension Secretary and setting up Universal Credit.
Yep.
So, Kieran, who would you like to, which politician would you be interested to
oh
see
my God.
Behind the scenes?
I think it'll be quite fun to watch the Angela Rayner
documentary
or reality TV show. I think that'd be quite fun, don't you?
Yeah, I'd watch, I'm going to steal our producer Frankie's idea, which was to see Liz Truss behind the scenes.
Oh my God.
Certainly the public face of Liz Truss was so bizarre on occasion, what she did in government, that it'd be interesting to see whether it was all an act or whether she actually believed some of the stuff
exactly
she came out
the
with.
Same.
Well, maybe we'll one day find out. Anyway, that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Helen Pidd here, presenter of Today in Focus. Whether it's crucial elections, conflict zones, or the fast-changing climate, we take you right to the heart of the story with our network of reporters from all over the world. The Guardian doesn't have a billionaire owner. We are completely independent of corporate interests or political influence. And we're funded by readers and listeners just like you. If you can, please do choose to support The Guardian. Just follow the link in the episode description.
This is The Guardian.
Wenn man Leute fragt, was macht einen Investor aus, bekommt man oft diese Antworten. Investoren sind reich. Sie tragen teure Anzüge und haben Designertaschen. Sie waren Einserschüler und sind Mathe-Genies. Interessant, aber das stimmt so nicht ganz. Man muss weder reich noch Experte sein, um zu investieren. Mit iShares ETFs kannst du in Hunderte und Tausende von Unternehmen mit nur einem einfachen Schritt investieren. Schon ab einem Euro. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fang noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
How can governments play a pivotal role as the world shifts? From decarbonizing the economy to sustainable care systems, bold government strategies are needed now more than ever. Get informed by listening to Government Insights, the new podcast from EY Parthenon. This series explores how government executives can transform their strategies into actions that are future-proof and sustainable. Government Insights is out now. Download today wherever you get your podcasts.